Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive, continuing our unending baseball coverage that doesn't include the Rush Tour or like football that's going on or anything else that's happening. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I'm doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour on the 26th at Coco's. Don't go to Coco's next week for a crab cake. Vacation week, so I'm wearing this now. So you get in the mood for it, and so you miss it next week, like Chick-fil-A on Sunday, and it'll be back on the 11th. We'll be there on the 26th. All are brought to you by our friends at GBMC and Farnan and Dermer. They are the comfort guys. I can't say that I was comfortable when I saw this guy. I don't know that we've ever met. I know that he's done the show many times, but not recently, and not really in the new iteration of Baltimore Positive since he wrote really an amazing book on the Astros. And we kind of have a guy here running things that was a part of the trash can banging era back in the day. But he covers the business of baseball. I will discuss trades with Tim Kirkchian and Buster Olney, and certainly Luke and I and Alan are getting after DeCostas this week. But this is more about the business of baseball because Evan Drellick covers the business of baseball, but once was a beat reporter in Houston and in Boston. And I used to call you when the Red Sox played the Orioles back in the day when the last time the team was good, like a dozen years ago, before they put Chris Davis in the Hall of Fame here this week. How are you? And congratulations on your book. And I'm so sorry I haven't had you on to discuss that, but we met on a 103 degree blazing day, in the Ashburn Alley during the All-Star game. And it's a pleasure to have you back on, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nestor. Every show I do now, there's some mention of crab cakes. I was on with there's a fellow named John Orand, who's a really great sports business reporter at Puck, and he had me on his podcast, and we were in, and he's I believe grew up in DC. And we were talking about where's the best crab cake in Baltimore. So I'm just kind of happy that crab cakes are still part of the progression for me because I was in Baltimore only a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I owe him a crab cake at Fadley's, and he's stolen my shtick on the internet, but he's doing it backwards. He's getting crab cakes from not in Maryland and sort of making fun of them, which is kind of cool. But like, I got other stuff I'm going to eat when I'm in your hometown, you know? So, you and I talked about labor and we got into it for 30 seconds. And dude, I'm in my 35th year. We're celebrating our 28th anniversary of Baltimore Positive, which isn't even impressive when you consider it doesn't cover the 94 strike, but I did before I had the station. I mean, we're going back here where we're talking about a third of a century ago that feels like 5 minutes ago to me. You know, when Angelos and Steinbrenner and Don Fear and Marvin Miller still alive at that point, and like Mark Belanger's barking, and you know, like I lived through that. My last name's Aparicio, and I've read the books, and I remember Curt Schilling and Mike Messina and Tom Glavine. My God, it was 30 years ago, and here we are still with really, I call it the original sin, like Adam and Eve, like the bad apple, and saying they've never fixed this, and now it's on Mr. Rubenstein's plate and not on Peter Angelos or Fredo's plate. It's not Bud Selig anymore. It's Manfred, who has spent his whole life kind of waiting for this offseason, right?
You could put it that way. The question is whether they actually get it done, it being the salary cap. And it's the question worth billions of dollars that all of us are trying to figure out as you head into next year. If the players remain steadfast that they don't want a cap, are Rob Manfred and that group that, as you point out, a newer group of owners with some new faces and maybe in some ways different thinking. Are they going to take it as far as they would need to take it to get to the point that the players say, okay, we'll stop fighting. We'll give you your cap. And nobody quite knows how long that would be. There's a lot of assumptions that that would be at least a year. It's a complicated thing on many, many levels. You're talking about Rob Manfred specifically. This might be his last negotiated CBA as commissioner, at least on the major league side. There's now a minor league CBA to negotiate, but this might be his last major league deal if he follows through on what he says he's going to do, which is retire in 2029, January of 2029. If he wants to come back, does he need to show a great effort and land a salary cap for the owners? But at this point, he says he wants to retire. So, and there's so many economic factors and push and pull with rights holders who are going to want the games to be on. And we could spend a long time talking about it.
Well, and we will, because 35 years ago when I began this, it's where we began, where the Orioles had all the money, the Blue Jays had a new stadium. And at that time, it was, we're going to build a stadium. That's going to fix it. Oh, no, we're going to have club seats. Oh, that's going to fix it. No, we're going to have sign. No, we're going to have a media. No, we're going to have a television network. We're going to have a regional sports network. We're going to have a BMO. And none of that I would say fixed it. It got a lot of people rich. It, helped the Angelos people cash out here, and the Rubenstein and Arrighetti people are trying to figure out what they own and what they can't own, which is the Battery, model in Atlanta, and how where this revenue comes from. And I'll just say this, Ev, the media part of this and that model, I have not met anyone from Rob Manfred down who can explain it to me. And I've owned an FCC license for 3 decades and sold media for a living and sort of try to understand cord cutting and all of the subs and all of the things that I have conversations about around here. I haven't had anybody that can explain to me where they think their revenue model is. So if they go to the Players Association, if they went to Marvin Miller and Don Fear and they're alive and well and say, all right, we have this, but they've always lied about their revenue and their revenue streams. They've always undercut it. They've always undercut each other, which is obvious when you have the Marlins and the Dodgers in the same stratosphere at 10X, right? But the media part of this, I don't know where the future is. They always had a predictive thing to say, give us a stadium, we can make money. Sure. Give us club level. They've on and on and on. Masson came here. Mr. Angelo said, we'll get rich. We'll be great. Okay. I don't know. We're 5 years from now. What is the model for them to, where's this money coming from, this revenue, as they see it?
Oh, I'd be a very wealthy man if I could tell you with full confidence what it's going to look like in 5 years. I should probably be doing something else. But the top level here, what the league and Rob Manfred wants to do is make, instead of this division between local and national television rights, basically make it all national. And so have the Dodgers and the Rays and the Yankees and the Marlins all put their local TV money into one pot and then share that pot equally. That's a very big change from the present moment, right? The Dodger TV rights are worth many times more than the Marlins TV
10X is
rights.
what I said. In some
Yeah.
cases, it's a billion X because some of these teams folded shop, literally, right? And I mean, they had teams that did not and do not get their games on television. I don't even know what to make of it. Now they're going to go to war over it. That's I just feels like have and have not was the story at Lords of the Realm. It feels it's going to be that way again, like where the players are going to say, "Why don't you guys get your house in order and figure out what you're doing first?"
Well, that is the crux of it, is the players in their own proposal. So the league proposes a cap. The players have made their own proposal. The players are also proposing major changes to revenue sharing between owners. They're just doing it without the upper salary limitation. The owners don't want that. They don't want to just change revenue sharing without getting this other thing that gives them this great economic gain. But to your question about where does this go in for TV rights, the general idea here is that you take more games national, you'll make more money because the Amazons and the Peacocks and Netflix of the world, they want to have as much live sports programming as they can, makes people sign up, blah, 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 blah. But right now, most teams have about 145 local games, something like that. And Rob Manfred wants to drop that number and say, all right, so your local broadcaster is going to get whatever. I don't know if it's 130, whatever the number is, it's lower. And those the difference, those whatever 15 additional games, now that gets divided up between this streaming company and that streaming company. So it's a transition toward just more national media. But still, you've baseball has so much inventory, you got to have a place to put it. And that's kind of the other piece of it where, okay, if a Netflix or an Amazon or one of these major streaming companies wants to be the local home for as many markets as possible, MLB right now has the rights to about half the league. I think it's 14 teams that are using MLB as a broadcaster. Okay. So, in a couple of years, could MLB sell 20 teams to Netflix? And Netflix can be your local home. So let's just say the Orioles were a part of this. Okay. In Baltimore, you want to watch your Orioles, your 130 Orioles games, you got to have Netflix. And so that seems to be where they're trying to take it, is just to capture as much of that streaming money as possible, both in the national and local levels. But where exactly it ends up in 5 years, I don't know, Nestor.
I keep thinking about the, by the way, Evan Drellick is our guest, longtime baseball insider writer, doesn't cover teams now, not on the beat anymore. Really, this is its own beat, which is the business of baseball, which I love flying into this world with you and Eric Fisher and oft times with other people that for 20 years I've had the Masson Angelos Nationals. Just why does our team suck? People come up to me and ask me that. And I go back to like when we couldn't keep Reggie Jackson and we couldn't keep, players back in the 70s and then got Camden Yards. And then, we were buying Robbie Alomar and Jimmy Key and, players. But literally this century where it's become incredibly imbalanced again. And look, the baseball nerds will sit up and say, well, there's been 31 teams that have made the playoffs. And how many worlds? But bullshit. The Dodgers and the Yankees wake up every year in the playoffs, and it's a broken system. And that really is, I say, the Garden of Eden. The original sin is that the NBA went to war to figure out, and the Wizards haven't figured it out yet, but the Knicks did, how to win. The NHL, which was always sort of a mess, and the Canadian dollar and all of that, lost a year. Football. It's amazing to me that when I have a football guy like you on that really knows football business. It's they're getting the 18th game. They're getting international play. They're getting anything they want. The league gets anything they want. They walk all over the union. And here, the salary cap, which to me as a fan, and this isn't an Aparicio thing, a business owner thing. This is just like what I think would be good for them, for the good of the game, as Bowie Kuhn would say, or Peter Ueberroth. Having teams have a fair fight is what makes the NFL to me. And it's what's made the NFL great. It's what's made it great for betting. It's what's made it great for fans. It's what's made it great that Lamar Jackson doesn't feel like he's leaving here right now, and Ray Lewis never did. And that happened for John Elway and a lot of other places where you get to build that, where Brooks Robinson built that here. I feel like baseball with the salary cap, the existential problem is the war and how much they hated each other 60 years ago. I don't know how much they hate each other, how they can gin that up, but I don't know how they can make this good for the players. And I keep wondering, like, okay, if Manfred, if this is your destiny that you're going to get this salary cap, what is the formula that players would find, current players, not Mark Belanger and Andy Messersmith, just where they are now that they can get away with this and finally jump the shark and get up with everybody else. So literally my little Orioles and the Pirates, and that there would be something that felt like what the Green Bay Packers and the New York Giants have, which is you don't think of them as whoever the Packers grow, the Giants are going to sign, which is baseball system from the beginning. And it's not a good system.
Yeah, there's kind of two main buckets to talk about here. There's the economic effects of a salary cap, and there's the competitive balance arguments around a salary cap. There are, and you can debate how much, crossover between them, but largely, I find it's usually productive to talk about them separately. Okay, so the question about what could the league do to entice players to take a cap? The player position, the union position, as you point out, for decades has been we don't want a cap, and they have a very, very long list of reasons why. It makes contracts in the union's eyes no longer guaranteed. Why is that? In a salary cap system, you have a revenue split, a predetermined percentage of money that goes to both the players and the owners. And at the end of every year, and you see this in the other sports leagues, you see this in hockey, you see it in basketball, you have to make good on that. And so if the league has lost money that year, it's below projections. Well, you're going to give money back if you're the player. So, and I'm pointing this out as one reason the players really don't want it. So, is there anything that the league could do that could convince players? Theoretically, if you made that revenue split so high that it was kind of clearly better to players in the aggregate for what they're making now, and the union says they're pulling in about 54, 55% of overall revenues right now, including amateurs. And it's a big fight over whether amateurs should be included in that counting.
Is there any dispute about the numbers, by the way?
Of
Is the
course there.
union
That's
okay?
there's a
So union,
dispute
you're
about
saying it's
everything.
54%, but you're screwing us. That's what we can prove. It's 54%, right?
The league likes to say it's closer to 47 or 48. And
Fair enough.
the
Okay.
union's beef with that is that it is not counting when the league says that amateur signing bonuses, so the amount of money that gets paid to players in the draft and the international signing period, that's hundreds of millions of dollars that does not get counted.
And the best players in the world in most cases, right?
Well, sure, the
Yeah.
best young players anyway. You know,
Yeah.
th these are the th
Players
these
of
are
impact.
yeah that are coming into the system. So, is there something the league could do to make it compelling to the players? You know, the interesting question here is whether they managed to reach that threshold. But my feeling is that what the league would have to give would be such a high percentage revenue split that they would no longer have interest in doing it. And it goes back to the bottom line reality that the baseball players have long ago identified, which is that they think their economic situation is better outside of a cap system. And look, the owners wouldn't want it if that was not the case. If the economic advantage for owners was to be in the current system, they would want to stay in the current system. They want it because it is better for them. And there's nothing wrong with that,
And
right?
dude,
Both.
we're on the third generation of them getting their ass kicked in 1973 because of everything that was stated in Lords of the Realm and the sort of feudal system that they had here, where Brooks Robinson, Louis Aparicio, and Frank Robinson all had to run in and beg a beer brewer for money because they couldn't, they had no other way to work. Literally, they had no other way to perform their vocation in a monopoly, in a legalized monopoly with antitrust, right?
Sure. And look, in the current moment, if the owners found, right, you're pointing out that the battles are not the same today. That everybody's in
I mean,
a
I'm crying
very
for
different
Boog
place.
Powell having to get a job at the brewery in the
Sure.
offseason 60 years ago, where, like, I'm in front of Adley Rutschman 5 minutes before I saw you and treats me like a rented mule. And I'm thinking, well, he's got $26 million. Of course he has more money than Cal Ripken ever had when I stood next to Cal, covered him for 15 years. So the money, Pete Alonso got $155 million in 20 minutes ago, couldn't run a rundown. So, like, we are dealing with have a lot and have nothing, and a media, much to our chagrin, you and I, that does not cover this, in a fundamentally sound way overall, so that the fans are going to wind up taking some side in this without even understanding it, because it's really hard to understand. And it's, to your point, when you saw me in Philly a couple weeks ago, it's going to become the only thing we really talk about baseball once baseball shuts down, because this is my third or fourth rodeo with this, and this feels uglier than all the rest for a lot of reasons. Just because I don't know where that next bucket of revenue is coming from, and there's a lot of nouveau riche business David Rubenstein types that aren't predictable. But the one thing I can predict is Bryce Harper and Verlander and whatever Gunnar Henderson they attract, whatever the ball players do, it's going to be in the same line if they're going to get handed the Marvin Miller playbook and told they have a strike fund and they're going to be okay, and they're going to fight like hell. That's as I see it, right? And that's where Sarasota gets swept up in this, and Phoenix, and spring training, and opening day, and these television networks, and the Rubensteins and the Arrighettis. I don't know where the fire in their belly is in the way that maybe it once was for the Lords of the Realm, who are now all gone. These guys just want to do good business, but I'm not even sure what good business is at this point.
Well,
If
remember,
good business isn't good competitive balance, I'm sorry.
private equity has arrived in the sport and other sports leagues and franchise values. The gigantic carrot here, if you ask me where the money is coming, besides media, which when MLB redoes its national media deals, they're going to make more money than currently. Right now, they make $2 billion and change a year from their national media contracts. The NBA is at $7 billion. The NFL is, 10 plus. They're gonna get closer to the NBA. Whether they get $7 billion a year on average, we'll see. But they're gonna make more money like that instantly. And then the other piece of it is the revenues, the franchises in other sports, the NBA, the NFL, they sell for a larger multiple of revenue than they do in baseball. An NBA team might go for 10 times its annual revenue, or 11 times, or 12 times. In baseball, it's like four, five, six, seven, somewhere in there, depending on the franchise. The owners want to increase that. You get a cap, you increase that instantly. You have cap labor costs, and well, that now you all of a sudden, when you go to sell your franchise, you're making a lot more money than you were before, and you have all these private equity groups now that are venturing into sports. That's what they want. They want to be able to sell to PE groups at a better revenue multiple at the moment. So there's people, there's eager buyers. And what some of these eager buyers want, what does PE need? It needs a return on investment, ROI at some point. So, there is money, there's plenty of money to be made. And a system that fixes your labor cost is a particularly valuable system when you're trying to market your sport to all these outside investors, like the Carlyle Group from which David Rubenstein comes.
Evan Drellick is here. He writes books on labor and ownership, and he offered his wisdom to me through The Athletic, and of course, wrote a great, great book. Fair to say, and I've only got you for another 5 or 10 minutes. I want to talk about your book a little bit because of the tentacles to Elias, and not specifically whether he's the buyer or the seller or the right guy or he's healed the Orioles or not. I would have fired him a year and a half ago when he fired the manager and hid from the media for 4 days and showed up in the Milwaukee dugout. But for me, with the Houston scandal and scandal in general, right? Like, I was in the locker with Sosa and McGuire back when you were younger, and and remember the Andrew Steen dying, like all of that. I covered Brady Anderson, like all of the steroid era and the cheating and the scandal and all of that. Your book really, it didn't unearth it. It unearthed the why behind all the trash can banging and who's in on it and all of that. And now we put a guy in the Hall of Fame the other day with it, which just continues to be, make me hold my nose. Cynicism in general, for me, 35 years into being an Aparicio who had my press pass taken away 20 years ago, who has a Caucasian employee who's credentialed and I'm not. I look at all of it and I'm very cynical about a lot of it. And I wish I weren't. I thought the new ownership group here would bring something that would feel like fresh air. And it's other than the dude making a bobblehead of himself and writing his own book on how much he knows about sports ownership when they're about to go on strike or walkout or lockout, or whatever this is going to be. The cynicism that anyone, Tim Kirchen was on this week. I have Buster on. Like all of us that have been at this a while, even Tom Verducci was just, no one feels good about this labor thing. And I think no one feels good about the people doing it. I don't feel good about any part of it or the people doing it. I feel like it's, this is baseball. To your point, you just went through the multiples and the Rubenstein groups and the car. Where are the people that like baseball?
I think they're still around. They're in the stands. I think even some of the people who own and operate these teams would tell you they like baseball. But I think to your point, the feeling that baseball is a business, that reality has taken over. And it's interesting to argue how is that different than 30 years ago. And one of the things that comes to mind immediately, Bud Selig, the former commissioner, was very good at, I think, always treating it like a business, but making you feel otherwise. He had that kind of avuncular way about him. He'd get up
He's a
there.
car salesman,
He was a
literally and
car
hard.
salesman. He'd
Come
get up there
on
and he'd talk
in, come
about
on
it.
in. We're gonna, well, you're gonna buy from me today. You're gonna buy tomorrow. Like that was a, that totally was American Eisenhower, World War II. I mean, it was a different kind of philosophy than how do we get caps into the seats and how much per beer can we, but with the calculators that he wasn't that he had a different feel about him. He really did.
Right, but whether in action, whether that feel is just something, a vibe that he gave to people that people ate up, and how different was it really behind the scenes? I think what is true in modern business generally compared to the 90s and even the early aughts when Bud was still around in baseball, everything is now more hyper focused on efficiency. Technology has helped enable that. Even Moneyball, that great concept, if you want to, and I say great in the sense of very large and expansive, which originates in baseball, has taken hold in all sorts of industries. Everybody's pushing for more efficiency now. But Manfred was asked at the All-Star game about whether he still believes baseball has a is a social institution, has a social responsibility, and this is something Bud Selig used to say a lot. Baseball is a social institution, and I'm paraphrasing, but. The commissioner's answer was basically, yes, but it's a business. We do think we have a social responsibility, and also we're a business. And I actually, in a weird way, appreciate Rob Manfred in the sense that I think he does a little bit less to try to hide that fact. I think with Bud, it was always, it's about baseball and the sound of the bat and the green grass and the hot dogs. And I think Rob Manfred's actually a little bit more direct in what the truth is, which is that, like any other multi-billion dollar industry, they are focused on revenues, growing profit, blah, 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 blah. That is the world we live in. And what is more American than that, Nestor?
Evan Drellick is here. He writes books and writes great, great pieces at The Athletic, where you can follow his work, and you will be once the manure hits the fan in labor here, once we get into the off season of all of this. I would just say all of these years later, when it's billionaires and millionaires, and that goes back to me being 13 years old in the summer 81, 82, when my dad canceled the sporting news, pissed off that he got mad at the sporting news and canceled it because there were no box scores in it anymore. So that's how, I go back to this in all the years in covering it on the radio and sitting through strikes and sitting through I was on the air my fifth year when we had the no World Series, right? And we didn't have a football team here either. But I would just say this, and I've said this out loud, and I've written this in my books on championships of Purple Rain 1 25 years ago now, Purple Rain 2 13 years ago. And I was the whore here pimping out for expansion team when Charlotte got one. And Jacksonville got one. And then we had to go steal a football team. And when we stole the team, the whole notion, and David Modell died, God rest his soul, never having lied to me, but also like really understood. And it wasn't bullshit. Like if you knew David, you knew that they did it wrong in Cleveland and they were going to be a community organization in Baltimore. They were going to have tailgating. They were going to involve the community, the Roosts, the local people, the local media, the fans, the long-suffering Colts people, the Colts player. It was going to be inclusive to the community because it's a community trust. Yeah, we're charging you for PSLs. Yeah, you're paying for the stadium. Yeah, you're going to pay for everything. That's cool. Won a Super Bowl. Also, had Ray Lewis in a jumpsuit, right? So we had the good and the bad through all of that. But the Ravens won the soul of the city at a time when Angelo stripped Baltimore off the name and just called the Orioles to try to keep DC, sold DC down the river all the way through, took all the money 21 years ago now. And we still haven't won playoff games around here. And for me, the whole notion of a community trust, Bisciotti bought this thing from Modell and said it's a community trust. He now lives in Florida half the time and is on a boat, doesn't spend any time here. The team doesn't act like a community team at all when they're playing in Brazil. And the baseball team, Brooks to Ripken, was community, community, community. We're the local team and all that. That really, the feel of all of that, they can't sell that with any authenticity anymore. Even if they put Palmer and Boog Powell, Cal Ripken in front of it, it just doesn't play that way and it doesn't feel that way, nor does your local university in general sense either anymore. But I think the basis of baseball, specifically, regionally and locally, was it's your hometown team. And now we're, it, that's gone and they have to find something else to sell. And I think gambling is, they thought that was going to be the bigger revenue stream. And I haven't even mentioned that. We're half an hour into that, Ev.
The thing that owners in sports can leverage, and the baseball lockout is a great example of this. Fans love their teams. They want to believe that these are community trusts and public trusts, and that it's being done for some sort of greater good. And that's not to say that there's nothing benevolent that's done by a Major League Baseball team. Certainly, there's a lot of charity work. You don't want to discount the good things that do exist. I think that's fair. But I think the objective reality is that, again, these are businesses,
They want your money.
they want money, and what the owners know is that kind of no matter what they do, I don't want to say no matter anything, but they can push fans even as far potentially as away from months of the sport if they shut it down for a time in 2027, and they will still expect fans to show up. It is the brand loyalty of fandom that makes these franchises in part so valuable and emboldens the owners to kind of do what they want to do. What's stopping them? If they look around and go, you know what? We can miss 2 months and these guys will come running back. They'll be so desperate to see their favorite, to see Pete Alonso go down the list. Who's going to tell them no? Everybody votes with their dollar, and as long as people keep buying $200 jerseys and $15, $16, $20 beers and all that, and people love it, people want to see their baseball team. Why wouldn't they? But that's the crux of it. Is it kind of doesn't matter what they actually do, as long as people are buying it.
I think maybe that's the whole thesis of Winning Fixes Everything, how baseball's brightest mind created sports's biggest mess. And we have people here running our team years later, making $1 million, $2 million a year running teams. To your point, they cheated, they won. F you, so what? Give us our ring. Fans come back. Everyone I know, from John McClain down to my cousin in Katy, Texas, has their Astros out, and they can't cheat. And my Venezuelan background would say, you're not gonna convince me, my Venezuelan brother at second base cheated. They all cheated. You wrote a tomb on it. Doesn't matter. There's still a line to get in down there. They've been back to the World Series. Like, doesn't matter, right? Really?
Yeah, it's interesting. The title of the book, "Winning Fixes Everything," and I think the Astros of 2017 are a particularly interesting example, because I think from here on out, for the rest of the history time that follows, there will be a discussion of, well, yeah, they won, but in almost all cases, it does fix everything. It fans being able to show up at the ballpark after a lockout, that'll probably fix most
You and
everything.
I do one thing wrong or unethical, it probably really ends, at least I felt that way for 35 years, and I've lived that way, as a public figure here, that my career would be over if I did anything on that edge of scandal, on that edge of scandal in a general sense. If I cut my competitor's wires so their radio station couldn't work, I would, I should freeze in hell. I find that sports, the cheat, you're not cheating, you're trying if you're not cheating, right? Like, whatever. Like, cheating pays. And I haven't figured out why that is, right on down to the President of the United States, but it is, we are an amazing place where that Mr. Rogers thing doesn't apply. I mean, especially with the Astros in your book, when I consider, like, they were a moribund sort of franchise with not much and this and that and whatever. And they're still eating off of all of that. It didn't wreck their brand at all. It powered their brand, really, financially.
The forces that come together to kind of create a cheating scheme, you can see analogs to what happens in with white collar corruption, right? A little bit what happens with the namesake of the Astros ballpark prior to going back to its opening, Enron, right? And it's not totally simple, but it is almost always the case that there's a great incentive, something that you want to achieve. You might be trying to protect something. In the case of the Astros, the cheating starts, and well, there's a group of guys that they don't want to let each other down. They don't want to let the other guys do the other teams do better than them. The circumstances that lead to cheating and corruption are actually they're fascinating to study, and they're not totally simple. But you could just boil it down to there's a lot of money attached and a lot of pride and success attached to following through on some of these schemes. And humans, people, fans want to forgive people when they make mistakes in a lot of settings. They look at their baseball players as heroes. It's not surprising to me that there's more forgiveness that exists for professional athletes who are looked up to and adored than might exist for you or me or the layperson in other jobs. So the cycles of forgiveness and cheating, we could do a whole hour on that alone.
Evan Drellick is here. Go follow his work out at The Athletic. He will be busy, busy, busy. So you get some rest, young man, because you're, and this is good. I mean, do you have any prediction? I mean, most people say, they'll play the mystery training. They'll be playing by April. But nobody predicts that, like, January 15th, they all buck up and we're just going to have spring training. And look, they got that salary cap. Or look, the owners just quit on it and they just want to have a season. I don't think that's going to, I mean, I don't think, I haven't had anybody that doesn't predict that this is a really problematic spring and winter, right?
Yeah, the only predictions I at this point I think I'm comfortable making is that you're not going to see an agreement prior to March. I would be surprised if that you could. It is technically possible. I just don't expect it. And I also would be really surprised if there was truly an entire season missed. Now that leaves a lot of leeway in between. But what I'm saying is, I think it's possible there are missed games. I think it's possible that they actually find a way to play without them still. But I don't know how to handicap it except to say an entire missed season. I don't believe the incentives are really there for anybody to do that, and particularly on the ownership side.
Well, feeling like where's the upside in that? But the war is on. Evangelic will be covering it at Athletic. Great seeing you. Thanks for the visit. Thanks for the deep dive. And this should hold up for all the next 6 months or so. So I appreciate it until there's any change. And thanks for coming on.
You got it, Nestor. See you soon.
Evangelic, go find the book. Winning Fixes Everything. A good little primer here on cheating and get you started on your Michael Elias history and going back to Jeff Luhnow and Jim Crane and all that good stuff as well. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore positive.